also, it's Slim Pickens today. I guess it's too hot to come to class, right? I just feel like I'm doing a lounge act. Welcome to the Kadapa Lounge. You'll be my guest for the evening. I do. I should bring my little electric piano up here. Do the talk while we play. Just play some nice chords. So I thought something fun to remind you guys of is Chokar Duchen. First time I made the banner, it said Chokar Duchen, so at least I fixed that. Chokar Duchen. It was a little southern drawl for the first one. So that's Thursday, and we have taken precepts off. I just want to remind anybody who is definitely excited to be here at 5:30 morning, because it won't be, we won't be here. So we've taken that off. So 11 o'clock, there'll be the animal blessing, and at 7, right at 7, I think, is the Shakyamuni Buddha Puja, which is one of my favorite things to say. I like to say that together. So because of that, I thought it might be a neat time to talk about the Lama Tisha statue. It wasn't really the place to do it, but, you know, I didn't say it Sunday. So if you did want to give to the Lama Tisha statue, imagine giving it on Chokar Duchen. It's like, you know, it's a Buddha. Wouldn't that be cool? So if you gave $10, it would be like giving $10 million or whatever the math is in the Buddhist math. So you can go online and donate, too. So some people don't know that. You can sponsor, which is a much higher ticket price. But if you want to combine that with somebody else who wanted to give, or you can just hit donate and give what you want. So, you know, it's just lingo. Don't donate, sponsor. It's okay. Either way, it's all the same pot. And so this is relying or relating? Is it relying on the spiritual teacher? Relying. Because I had made the banner. I had to change that one, too. Because it's the semantics was kind of made some meaning to me, relying on the spiritual teacher instead of relating, right? That's a big difference. So you're here to learn how to rely. And that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. You have only two chances to do it. So you have to really listen. It's going to be chock full. And anything else? Anybody ask questions on? Erin's here for you. And there she is. Yep, so we'll see if anybody else is coming. Don's your teacher tonight. What else do we talk about in these little brief interludes? I think that's it. And then we are going to, when does the next one start, Erin? Yeah, she's got all that good stuff, so I bid you.
Good evening, everybody. Don Brown is on his way in. As Jill mentioned, we are have a class for the spiritual teacher. I have mentioned during the last class, if you have any completion forms that you want to turn in, especially if you have one from presenting the path, Don is right here, so I can give him the stack of forms and ask him to go through them and sign them and things like that. If you have any other ones from any other classes, it's great to give those to me as well. Next week, our class time is 6:30 to 9 o'clock, and that is on the website. It's consistent with what I'm saying right now. Unfortunately, I am not going to be here. So if there's anybody who is able to come to set up, either stop by during the day and do this format of the setup or be here maybe by 5:15, so that, unless you have building access and you can come a little bit later, that would be very helpful to see me after class. That's really all I have to say as far as announcements. So our next one after this is not until September 20-something, the end of September, and Robbie's going to be leading that one. So we have just this week and next week for this class, and then again in September because of Light of the Path and all those things. Any questions? All right, well, welcome, and I'm glad to see you guys here because we had a bit of a break, and it's summer, and, you know, I think this is a pretty good turnout considering all the things that we have going on right now. So turn it over to Don when he gets his microphone on.
So, Peter,
oh, if you are not in the U or on, like, there's a U of, yeah, there's one, there's, yeah, there's a line, U cushions, and then there's one row after that, and we can all fit. Yeah. Most of us have some kind of name tag on.
It might be. Oh, there you go. Okay. So we'll start out by introduction. So how many people are new to discovering Buddhism, like you hadn't been here ever before? Well, bless your heart. We've got a few newbies here. So you know, you're jumping. How many, do you have any experience with Buddhism? You do? You do? Meditation. So it's not like you, we're not talking physics here, you know. This is not like you're jumping in the middle of, you know, a semester of calculus or something. And this is actually a very profound subject, which I'm beginning to appreciate more. I shortened it to 2 weeks. Well, actually what happened was that the place was booked last week, so it got shortened from 4 to 2 weeks, but we decided even 2 weeks was better than nothing. So anyway, I'm Don Brown. I'm a long-time Kadampateer, and I have taught this class at some point in my life, but I can't remember when, but you know, looks at bits and pieces of it over the 25 years the center's been here. At some point or another, I've talked about it, but I'm not an expert in, I'm not a guru, I'm not an expert in this particular subject, but I think I know, at least I hope I know more than you do. No, I don't know, there might be some Buddhist scholars here. Anybody here a Buddhist scholar? No? Okay, good. Whew, that gives me a little breather here, so don't worry about that. Anyway, if you are, that's great. I'd love some help, because this is a tricky subject. So really, we're going to talk about the spiritual guide and why that's important, and the attitude we need to have, and the qualities of the student and the qualities of the guide, and what happens if things don't go right, and what happens if the guide or the student fall off the wagon, so to speak. A lot of things to think about, you know, in the terms of the spiritual guide. And then there's a spiritual guide at the beginning level, right, where we are. And then there's the spiritual guide at the highest level of Tantra. Now, do you mind taking your hat off, please? Thank you. You're not supposed to wear a hat at Dharma teachings, believe it or not. It's supposed to, you know. I got in trouble one time for doing that. I'm not going to tell you what happened, but it was embarrassing. What? Oh, that's fine. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. So, one of the things that, Lama Zopa admonished us to do at the beginning of every Dharma class, everything that we do at Kadampa Center, is to take a couple of minutes to think about the motivation for why we're here. You know, and so is anybody here that came here tonight with their mind dead set on supreme enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings? I mean, they've been completely obsessed by the thought of helping others, and the method to do that would be becoming enlightened. Anybody have that motivation? Thank you. Well, that's incredible. Anybody have the motivation? I just want some help with my life. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of motivations we could have. It could be just to make it through this day. It could be to make it through, help us deal with anxiety and stress and depression of just being human in this lifetime. And then there could be a motivation of maybe a future lifetime. Christians practice that way, don't they? They think, you know, I want to be a good Christian and be Christ-like so I can, you know, go to heaven. My next life will be, you know, with God and all my friends. And if you're you know, a Mormon, you'll get to see your wife and everybody else. I mean, so many different beliefs, isn't it? But anyway, in Christianity, it's about the next life. And so we could practice Buddhism. Again, this is, and this presupposes that you have at least a little bit of, you're open to the notion of rebirth. How many people are open to the notion of rebirth? How many people are completely, think it's a bunch of crazy hooey? It's okay. Nobody. So, you know, it's an evolutionary thing. You're having faith in rebirth takes time. It's not a, you know, but there's some logic that we can talk a little bit about during this class if we have time. But so practicing so that the next life is better is a great motivation, and many spiritual traditions, as we just said, do that. And then practicing so that we can achieve liberation, that's like complete cessation of suffering, nirvana, right? And that could happen in this life, but chances are it's going to take lots of lives to do it. But it could happen in this lifetime. So nirvana, that's the meaning of nirvana, is the total cessation of suffering. That would be a wonderful motivation to have. And, you know, when we remove suffering from a Buddhist perspective, what's there is like fantastic joy and freedom and, you know, it's quite wonderful. So, because our basic nature is pure and happy and joyful. And so we as Rabina says, we weed the garden, we get all the negative stuff out of there, and then the flowers that we planted can bloom. And so nirvana is the complete experience of our basic goodness, you might say. Not quite the complete experience, but so that would be a great motivation to be here, is I want to achieve nirvana. I want to stop all of my suffering. That'd be awesome. And what a contribution to the world we'd be if we could do that. And then the most auspicious motivation, which is the one I mentioned a moment ago, and the one that we want to try to make an effort to effortfully for most of us, I generate, is called bodhicitta, or the awakening mind. It's where we, and it's based on, and you know, we had a whole class on this where we did 13, you know, contemplations and or 11, and we went through each stage, and ultimately generated bodhicitta, because it's not a natural way to think. We don't automatically think, I want to dedicate my life to others. I want to completely dedicate my life to others and develop all of my qualities so I can become a perfect guide. But that's what bodhicitta is. It's an instinctual desire to help others that we've developed through contemplations over lifetimes usually. And it's based on genuine love and compassion. So we set as our goal supreme enlightenment. Why? Because we want to really help others. Because that's the only person that can truly be of the greatest benefit to others is a fully enlightened person. What is a fully enlightened person? It's you and me when we achieve our full potential, when all of our limitations are removed, all of our negativities are gone, and all of our positive qualities are developed, you know, wisdom, compassion, loving kindness, power, skillful means, all of those things that constitute what we would call the qualities of Buddha. So that's the motivation that we want to, as much as we can, to develop, is this effortful bodhicitta. And I say effortful because it does take effort. It is the total antithesis of egocentricity. Ego does not want to dedicate your life to others. Ego wants to feel good and avoid pain and experience pleasure and avoid anything unpleasant. I mean, that's just how it is. That's how our egos operate. And so bodhicitta is antithetical to that. And so, again, motivated by sincere love and compassion, which is, you just can't say, I love him, I love her, I want them to be free from suffering, I want them to have happiness in its causes. It doesn't just happen that way. Usually it takes effort, but we have to focus on the good qualities of others and see that they're just like us in wanting happiness and not wanting to suffer. So we're all equal that way. And we develop this sense of loving connectedness. We're the same in this really, really important way. Something we know very intimate about each and every one of us in the room is that we all want to be happy and none of us want to suffer. You know, and the cause of all of the unhappiness that we've ever experienced is self-centered selfishness. Just, and I would just challenge you to argue that with yourself. Is that really true, that selfishness is the cause of all the suffering from the beginning of beginningless lifetimes until now, between people, between, you know, communities and nations? It's all about selfishness and self-centeredness. And the cause of happiness is cherishing others. It's this mind that sincerely is dedicates and loves others and cherishes others. As long as I had a bumper sticker one time, for happiness, simple, cherish others. For happiness, cherish others. And so we come to the point where we make this determination that I am personally responsible for the happiness of all beings throughout all space and time. It's my job. This is the attitude of a bodhisattva. Because we're all interconnected, and in so many profound and not so obvious ways, that your happiness is important to me. You know, so we make this determination. I am personally responsible for the happiness of everyone, all beings throughout all space and time. And again, this is not a messianic vow, to use Bob Thurman's term, a messianic vow. It's based on genuine love and compassion, and I'm personally responsible for helping guide others wherever they are in their spiritual evolution, from whatever degree of suffering they're experiencing, to guide them from that to supreme enlightenment. This is the vow of the bodhisattva. And then the next step, which is a pretty obvious one, is that we go, well, I can't even do that for myself. I can't even do it for myself. How can I do it for others? And so we make this determination, well, with the realization that the only way we could ever do that is if we had developed our qualities to the nth degree and eliminated our faults. If we had done that, then we could truly be a benefit to others. Before that, some benefit, and we can grow and become more and more beneficial with each passing day and year and lifetime. But, you know, this is the Buddha. What we want to do is become a Buddha in order to be a perfect guide to others. So this is bodhicitta. This is this awakening mind. So said another way, we're here tonight for others, because we want to plant seeds on our mind stream, plant seeds in our garden that will ripen in these beautiful flowers called nirvana and supreme enlightenment, so we can help others. It's the only reason to be here. It's because we sincerely want to help others. And to do that, we have to train our mind. We have to eliminate our faults and develop our good qualities. It's so simple. It's just what it's what we have to be focused on, and without that, not much is going to happen. Something might happen. Some seeds will get planted, but they're just ripened in a new car or some or a nice vacation. They won't ripen in terms of spiritual realizations and nirvana and enlightenment. It won't happen that way. So we've got to start out from the very get-go with this heartfelt bodhicitta awakening mind. I must become a Buddha, and I must become enlightened in order to help others. That's the attitude we have to have. So let's watch the video. Now the video is, I wish we could skip through the first part and get to the nitty gritty, but anyway, there's a movie star in the first part of it, but I guess that's okay. Anybody see The Matrix? He actually played the little Buddha and, right? Didn't he play the little Buddha? Anyway, yeah, I think he did. Keanu Reeves. The bottom line, you know, that video is bottom line. And I can tell you, you know, it's not, from my personal experience, you know, most of the texts that we read here, you know, we've done the foundation of all good qualities, right? Teaching my Lama Tsongkhapa, the first verse almost of every text starts out in Tibetan Buddhism, starts out on the importance of the spiritual guide. That's like number one. However, in other texts, for example, there's a Lam Rim by the fifth Dalai Lama and some other Lam Rims where they don't put these teachings on the reliance of the spiritual guide in the beginning. And I think in the Kagyu and Nyingma tradition in particular, they come later on also. And it kind of makes sense, doesn't it, when you think about it? Because you don't know anything. You don't know anything. So why would you, you know, if you don't even know who these people are or you don't know what they're teaching, you know, you don't know how great they are because you haven't had a chance to hear them. You haven't had a chance to try their practices on for size so you can see if it works for you. I must admit my experience. John Fay, the last person that was speaking, I remember when I first got introduced to Buddhism in 1978 in Nepal, and I didn't go to that course, that November course. It was like a month-long course. I didn't go to that course to be a Buddhist. I mean, I was just there to learn how to meditate and figure out how to be happy. And I wasn't getting enlightened and all this stuff. Sounded good, but I was just there for myself. And but the more I listened to the teachings, the more I thought, wow, this is And then I did the meditations, and I could see my mind shifting just in a month. It was pretty amazing to me to see that I was actually benefiting from this. That, and I was very skeptical. I mean, I just drove, you know, Lama Zopa's current attendant, Roger Kunsang. He wasn't his attendant then, but Roger was a monk. And I kind of, he and I became, well, at least I latched onto him, I should say. I bugged him every which way. I asked him every question. Well, where's compassion for yourself in Tibetan Buddhism? And blah, blah, blah. You know, I just, everything I could think of to ask, you know, what is this rebirth stuff about? And how do you prove that anyway? So, but at the end of the day, the teachings made sense. But I said, you know, I've got to go meet these two lamas, Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa. I got to go make sure. Because, I mean, there's a lot of great teachings out there, right? I mean, there's a lot of really wonderful religions. I mean, I tried, I'm a lapsed Presbyterian, by the way, but I've forgotten what they even believe now, but somebody help me here. Anyway, I'll think about it. It'll come back to me. But anyway, my whole family did that, and it was helpful. I mean, we learned about ethics and all that kind of stuff, but I still felt like I've got to go meet these lamas and see if they're really what everybody's telling me how great they are and all this kind of stuff. But if they are as great as people say they are, then these teachings are pretty cool. Because if this is the kind of person they produce, then I'm on board. So I got an interview with Lama Zopa one-on-one. So I was quizzing him, you know, not exactly, but I did get a chance to talk to him one-on-one, he'd been teaching the whole month. So I had gotten to know him that way. And I thought, he is not your average Joe. You know, he is definitely on a different plane than most of us. And then I got a chance with about six other people to go see Lama Yeshe, because Lama Zopa was the bad cop, Lama Yeshe was the good cop. And he was also, like, you know, Mr. I don't know what you say, but he had a lot of charisma, and he was funny, and he really, I mean, he could walk into a room and, you know, as they were talking about, just the presence, his presence would warm people's hearts. It was amazing. So anyway, to get in to see him, you had to get into a group of six. And I was listening to him and just trying to, you know, everybody else was all in, but I was checking him out, trying to see, and to the best of my ability, and who, you know, that's limited. After I had the opportunity to meet these people, I thought, well, you know what? This gives more credibility to the teachings than anything I've read or experienced. Because if these teachings can produce these kinds of people, and at that time, Lama Zopa, the younger Lama Zopa, he didn't sleep at all. He didn't sleep at all. He never laid down. He constantly, 24/7. I mean, he did different kinds of meditation. I'm sure he did something to restore himself. He would get deep enough so that he could keep his health. But his whole life was totally dedicated to others, to his spiritual practices and praying for others and people had problems. I'd never heard of anybody like that. He was so off my radar screen, and I just thought, this is, and people even now that have seen him up at, you know, when he comes to visit here, he'll be here next month. I mean, he's had a stroke. And Robbie and I were out in California a couple of years ago visiting his house, and he still doesn't sleep. He's up at like 3 o'clock in the morning doing fire pujas, you know, for spirits and for his students and to remove obstacles. I mean, he's so complete. His heart is so complete. And where does that energy come from? And would not, you know, I'd like to have a little of it, like to have a little of what he's got. So that's kind of, the importance for the real down to brass tacks importance of the spiritual teacher for me was it made the Dharma real. What I had experienced was now I could see that there were people out there who'd been practicing it for their entire lives who had extraordinary gifts and qualities that I thought were cool. Things that I'd like to develop. So let me have you break up into groups of like 3 or 4, and I want you to just talk to each other about like the importance of teachers in your life, the importance of a teacher. You know, I mean, can you get it out of a book? If there have been teachers that have made a difference, what was the value of being with a living teacher? So, let's do that for a few minutes. You can just find 2 or 3, like groups of 4 would be good. To think of becoming a disciple.
Very, I'm so proud of you. But I don't think book learning is going to put down.
Right.
There's a lot about studying, you know.
Mostly. So let everybody talk in your group. We need to wrap this up in about another minute or two. Okay, let's wrap it up here. I'm inventing this class as we go. There's so much to cover, and yet there's not much to cover. It's so clear we need a teacher, right? I mean, it's so clear. And we need a good teacher. We don't need some crackpot who says, hey, go fly that plane into the World Trade Center. I mean, that's a bad teacher. He's giving bad advice. And if you buy into that, if you pick the wrong teacher, you can waste your whole lifetime. So it is a really big, big deal. And then how do you find a teacher? How do you find one? Anybody got any ideas about that? Hello? Pardon? All right, well, ask it. What's your question?
Thank you. Well, you were talking earlier, you met two what I think are unbelievable lamas. How do you, you know, if you're like, okay, I think either one of these would be great teachers, how do you make that decision? Did it just come to you? You felt, oh, you know, I got that. There was something there.
It really was. I had no intention of being a Buddhist. And I wrote in my diary, I had a little, you know, what do you call it, when you're taking notes and all, journaling. And I kept saying, I'm not going to be a Buddhist. I'm just here to learn how to meditate. And then halfway through, I've been a Buddhist my whole life. They just put words to everything I've intuited and showed me how to develop the things that I want to work on. But anyway, it was very, you know, I just consider it my extraordinary good karma. I don't have good karma in some things, but I have great karma in spiritual teachers. And so I just happened to be in Kathmandu, Nepal in 1978. With a camera to go up there and take pictures at the monastery. And I heard about this course from this beautiful Swedish nun. Okay.
Any Karen?
Yeah, good. Did you speak to her?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we go way back. And, what now? Oh, she told you about me? No, well, there's not much to say. Anyway, she's so sweet. But yeah, she was talking about this 1 month course, and she said, "And look, you got to commit to it. You just can't be rolling in and out. You got to stay in the monastery." And there were 200 of us Westerners that stayed there, and a few people bailed, but probably 99% of the people stuck it out, because the whole point is, just because your mind says, I'm not having fun, I think I want to go down back to Kathmandu where all the drugs and all the fun people are. And, well, that's just a thought, isn't it? I mean, that's the whole point, is to tame our mind and not be a slave to all our little impulsive thoughts to do this and do that. So you make the commitment. And so, so I just got very lucky. You know, I'll call it good karma, to have met Lamas Open on the Eshe, and then later on have met, you know, people like Tsokhon Rinpoche and the Dalai Lama and Ling Rinpoche, the Dalai Lama's senior tutor. I mean, just a lot of great teachers that I met back in the late 70s and early 80s that most of them were the senior teachers that escaped from Tibet. And then most of them died off. Only a few are still alive. But the point is, you have to be open. And I was open. You know, I mean, if but this is actually brings up my next point here. Before I go off, let me hear from each of the groups. One person who is in each of the groups, summarize what you guys learned from each other. Who wants to take the first group over here? All right. There's microphone.
Well, so we had a really lovely conversation about the teachers that are in our lives. Just to kind of bring it into a mundane realm a little bit, mm-hmm. and to talk about the value of teachers, school teachers, elementary school teachers, the Montessori. Was your son training to be a Montessori teacher?
Elementary.
Oh. Okay. And then Sue's children were learning how to swim from a teacher who had the skills to impart to the children, and also this beautiful enthusiasm that made them overcome their dislike of swimming and then be able to do it safely without dying. And mm-hmm. so we talked about that, that I thought that was a really extraordinary metaphor for living in samsara, that we are all in samsara, we're all in the pool together, and if you could learn how to swim, then you might avoid drowning painfully and you might be able to swim to the other side, and you might be able to do a number of things. The metaphor of it just sort of bloomed in my head, and I loved it. So there was that. And then Robbie was talking about having met Lama Zopa, no? And the beautiful, the way that the teacher speeds up the process. Wasn't that one of the things, the kind of how necessary a teacher becomes or is from the beginning, or perhaps somewhere along your path? And then didn't you ask a question about meeting the teacher? How do you meet the teacher? I couldn't, yeah, I'm trying to remember. Yeah. Right, that some people haven't met gurus yet. Yeah. So, yeah, we had a really lovely conversation.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay, if you can pass the mic on to the next group. Just summarize what your... You don't have to tell what everybody's experience was. So there's always one talker in every group, so whoever's got the mic, go for it.
Well, thanks. I mean, we did talk about how important it was to have a teacher, and when a teacher showed you anything, whether it be athletics or anything, there it's easier to get from point A to point B when you have somebody to show you how to do it successfully, because mm-hmm. we thought that was what you had asked us to focus on.
Yeah.
We have a lot of other questions. I mean, as an example, we talked about how do you find a teacher, but also the big question is you don't want to commit too early, and I mean, you know, you take 10 or 12 years to study somebody, what do you do in the interim? You know, that's a good question.
Well, you can. Well, that's a good question. Let me write that one down. 10 or 12 years. Woo! All right. Go ahead. Keep talking. Who's next?
I'm over there, so you get you four.
Aaron. She wasn't in our group. Make it up. No. So we kind of talked about how we don't have a teacher, and we kind of pull our teachings from different places. So I, for instance, I watch a lot of FPMT teachers on YouTube, or we have life experiences that open us up to things, or we read from different, I don't know what the right word is, from different resources where we pull insights, but it's more of an individual journey. So it's because it's hard to find a teacher that you know that is qualified to teach you, that you trust mm-hmm. to teach you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were lucky enough to meet somebody that you felt that in your gut, but we haven't necessarily met that person.
Yeah.
And how do you know where to go to find that, and how to make sure they have the qualities that you need?
Good question. Pass it on. That's really the, I mean, that's the work that's got to be done. You got to create the karma to have it happen.
Yeah, but you don't get to talk. You had some great examples.
So part of our discussion was about how it is key to pick the right teacher to succeed for you as a student. But also we heard about a lovely example of how a teacher who is committed to your success is key in your learning and growth process. Another topic that we discussed was how important it is to be compatible, the concept of compatibility between the student and the teacher, and how to find a teacher in terms of compatibility that learn that can speak to you and can speak your own language, your own share your experiences and guide you through the path, whatever that learning path is.
Okay. I'm going to put in here different cultures. Because Tibetan culture, very different than Western culture. Anything else? Anybody else? Okay. So, these are great, you know, the...
One more thing is like proximity to the teacher. Like, how important is that? We were talking...
Oh, proximity to the teacher, like... We were talking about how there's so many more people studying Buddhism than there are teachers, so you have to rely on virtual means to experience their teachings.
Yeah, and is virtual guru as good as being in the same room with the guru? I'm talking about virtual office visits now, too, for the doctors.
The one thing that I think I heard you say is we don't have a teacher. We're doing this on our own.
Yeah.
And that's a very uncomfortable situation unless you have the commitment to say that, will you be my teacher? Because most of us are grasping at different things as opposed to having a teacher.
Well, see, now, I want to make this point clear, too, that, for example... You know, Robbie's teaching the next Discovering Buddhism module. I'm teaching this one. And then, you know, Aaron's going to teach a module. And I mean, we're all, you might say, spiritual teachers, but we're not, you know, but, and early on you rely on the beginners, you know, people that are a little bit more advanced than you are to learn what you need to know. In fact, Lama Yeshe used to say that he felt Westerners learn better from other Western, more, you know, senior students. And, you know, because we have similar cultural experiences and can put it into, give examples and such as that are relevant to us. So I think that's, you know, so the teacher that you have now in Discovering Buddhism, I mean, we're teachers, spiritual teachers, you might say, but not in the full sense of a tantric master who's a teacher, who you're, you know, who, now this sounds really wild, but there's a, you know, in the most advanced levels of Buddhism, we're instructed to see the teacher as a Buddha. Like to see the teacher as a Buddha. And all this devotion and stuff. You think Lama Zopa gives a hoot about that? Or the Dalai Lama? Not a bit. Not a bit. Who does it benefit to humble yourself to another human being that you, and say, this person knows more than I do about something that's really important to me. And, you know, you bow, and I mean, it's a traditional Tibetan thing. I mean, for the West, you know, as Westerners, we might go, you know, hi. You know, I think that'd probably be as much as we could do. But the Tibetans is very traditional for them to, you know, to bend over and to try to get lower than the teacher and have their hand in their heart. And, you know, and at the center, we're, it's kind of weird. We do it on Sunday morning when Geshe-la comes in, everybody gets really low and bends forward. But that comes from that, you know, showing, you know, the teacher, trying to show the teacher respect. Because that person is getting ready to impart to you the secrets for your happiness from now until the end of time. Is going to help plant some seeds that will ripen in your future happiness. So, wow, what a cool person. I mean, they do deserve our respect and admiration. So, anyway, this 10-year thing, 10 to 12 years, yes. You know, Lama Atisha spent 12 years checking out his main guru. But it wasn't like he wasn't studying the whole time. He was practicing and studying, but in this context, and not in the sutra context, but in the tantric context, that's where it's so, so important to check out the guru because that person is basically going to be responsible. I mean, you're entrusting your life to that person, your spiritual real estate, your spiritual life. You're asking them to guide you, to help you choose the right practice for your mind and your predispositions, and then teach you how to do it, and then help you when you run into a wall or something like that. In other words, to really guide you at the highest level, if we're ever lucky enough to be able to practice at that level, where we had a tantric master, then we would need to be able to see them as a Buddha. Well, I put three things of water back here just to give you an example of how our mind, because, you know, I don't know anybody's mind here. I mean, the only thing that we can say about, we don't know a guru's, we don't know a teacher's mind, do we? All we know is what they say and what they do. What comes out of their mouth and what actions of their body. That's all we can say. We don't know what's happening in their mind. And so we have to look and see when we're choosing a teacher. And if our mind is really polluted, there's a great example in the teachings of how if you're a being in the hungry ghost realm, you would see this as pus. This bottle, this thing over here, as pus. If you're a human being, what is that? Yay, we got all humans here tonight. Good. And if you're from the God realm, what is that? Nectar. Any gods here? Demigods? That's nectar. So, it's like beauty's in the eye of the beholder. If we bring all of our judgments and criticisms, we could be in the presence of a great teacher and not see them as a teacher. You know, if our mind is literally in the lower realms, in the dumps, then we see pus. We can't see the good qualities of the teacher. And, you know, someone who's very, really evolved only sees the good qualities. And it's not like we're told to shut our discriminating awareness out when we're choosing a teacher. We need to be able to recognize when somebody's behavior is a little bit off, but we need to be able to focus on their good qualities. Now, wouldn't that be great to be able to do that in real life with everybody, particularly ourselves? I had this experience with Lama Yeshe, and this was also, this is like one of those aha moments about the teacher. This is 1980, and I had taken the first course in 78 and had studied and so forth. And I went to a course that he was given at Grizzly Lodge in California. There were a bunch of people, there were maybe 150 people there. And And I had decided that he was my guru, you know, my guru. And so everybody said, well, you need to see him, you need to see him as a Buddha if he's going to be your guru. I went, well, oh, what does that look like? And but what I decided to do was, by the way, I invite you to do this with anybody. But look, no matter what he did, I saw it as a teaching. So he had a habit of rocking back and forth. It used to annoy me. All of a sudden, I used to go, okay, he's teaching me patience. Or he'd be going, clearing his throat, you know. Or sometimes he'd rock back and forth and his eyes roll back in his head. And I'd be going, how weird is this? You know, but I went, okay, I'm going to suspend my judgment and see everything he does as a teaching, as an opportunity for me to develop my mind, to see my own mind. He was like showing me, all of a sudden, there's this being who I've decided is perfect. Now, where are all these judgments and criticisms coming from? This one. And I got to see what a mess my mind was, how I was constantly judging and criticizing not only myself, but here's this holy being whose only wish is to help me. And I'm over there trying to finding fault with every little thing he does, missing the teaching, so to speak. So that was a great... So from the moment I decided to see him as a Buddha, which is the last couple of days of the teachings, it was so much more fun for me. I so much more enjoyed it. And so from that perspective, it didn't help Lama Yeshe at all. It doesn't help the guru, the true, you know, the spiritual master at all, for you to see him as a Buddha, or her as a Buddha. But it is hugely helpful for our own mind. As long as we don't get stupid, right? We cannot suspend our... If your guru says, for example, to go out and kill 100 people, don't do that. You know, that would not be smart. Or there have been lots of examples of, and I'm saying both ways, male, you know, gurus, you know, misbehaving with their female students, and female gurus misbehaving with their male students. So that one's gone both ways. And you just got to be careful, you know. If something doesn't sit well with you, that, you know, it doesn't fit what you would consider to be ethical behavior, you need to be willing to stand up. Don't be stupid. Don't go, you know, don't, you know, you say, look, this, you know, you might ask your teacher, like, you can say, that seems like it's not virtuous. Why would you ask me to do that? What would be the point of that? You know, in other words, that's completely appropriate. And it's also said that once, you know, again, in the beginning, like people like Robbie and me and the other DB teachers, we have the whatever you want to say, we're spiritual teachers or Buddhist teachers or whatever, Dharma teachers, I guess you'd say, but we're like kindergarten, you know, we're at the very lowest level, but you know, then you'll find we'll have people that will come along like Venerable Rubina and, you know, a lot of, I think Don Hendrick is a very special person and he's a lay person. And then, you know, we'll have Geshe Gelek and then we'll have, you know, we'll have Lama Zopa and then we'll have the Dalai Lama. You know, when he comes, which is supposed to be in our lifetime. We don't know for sure, but he's supposed to come. So, anyway, any questions about what I've said so far? Yeah. So, what is... I'm sorry.
Would you elaborate on the Dalai Lama is supposed to come here in your lifetime?
Yeah. I mean, he's actually... Robbie went on television. Many people have seen him. He's quite recognized no, I'm just kidding. A lot of people have seen, you know, Robbie got interviewed because the mayor had said His Holiness was coming in October. and of this year, October 15th, yeah, to Raleigh. And so, but there's some question about whether it's going to be this October or next April. So we, you know, nobody knows for sure right now. But definitely, there's a commitment for him to come to Raleigh for 3 days, 2 or 3 days, and to give, you know, public talks and teachings and whatever, you know, lots of different aspects to his teaching, to his visit. Yeah.
You asked. Just following up on your, does anybody have any questions?
Yeah.
Without you and Robbie and everybody else who sat in that chair, I would not be where I'm at today, and I am grateful. But you're imparting knowledge to me, and you're teaching. But we're also, when we talk guru, we talk about, well, gee whiz, I can come to you and I can ask you all these things, and you would ask me all these things, and they're sort of commitments, even at a lower level.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we go to find that? Now,
find what now?
Where do we go to find that kind of guidance now, or in the short term, in the next 6 months, in the next
what
year?
What kind of guidance,
Don? How about if you and I have coffee once a month, and you give me some guidance on what I need to do next so that Jack can be a better person? That's the kind of baby steps that I would like to have,
mm-hmm.
but you got 1,000 things to do, and I'm grateful for what you've been able to give me by sitting right there. Where do we go for really to have somebody give us some direction?
Well, you know, we do have, I mean, there's, you know, you're right, I do have 1,000 things to do, but guess you know, we do have two teachers here. We have two Tibetan monks, and by the way, you know, our Tibetan teachers, their job is not to solve our samsaric problems, like, well, I'm having trouble with my children, or, I mean, they might give you advice on this, but, you know, their job is to help guide us spiritually. You know, like, I have issues with anger, so what practices would be helpful for me to do? You know, purification practices and practices developed, you know, what books to read and like that. So I hear exactly what you're saying. And, you know, sometimes people say that when the student's ready, the teacher will come. It sounds such a platitude. But I think as we progress on our spiritual journey, you know, the teachers will show up. When you're ready, for example, to enter the Vajrayana, the Vajrayana teachers will be here. You know, we'll figure, if enough people want to practice Vajrayana and have a strong, firm basis in the Lamrim, then we can get someone to come and give an empowerment, and we can learn to practice, do some of those more advanced practices, and then get a tantric master to actually give us those empowerments. But, you know, when the student's ready, the teacher will show up. I think that's true. Now, let's see, compatibility. I just want to say this. Alex Berzin, and I just had the best, I probably spent, I don't know how many hours, reading Alex's thing on the spiritual guide. You know, the Berzin archives, it's referenced in the stuff that we handed out, isn't it? I know it's online, referenced on the online thing, but I'm not sure if it's referenced here.
So if you go to that FPMT online learning, and
yeah.
You, oh, and I forgot to change the image on that. Click on the one that it's, click on the one for spiritual teacher, and there will be something in there about Alexander Berzin and some of the readings, but it's not, I don't think it's in, I can't remember if it's in online readings.
Yeah, I don't think it is. But I think what one of the things that Alex is really masterful at is he understands the Western mind. You know, and for the, like the Tibetans have a completely different attitude about the guru and how to relate to the guru. And so, you know, we're in the West, and gradually there will be some Western students that become evolved enough to actually, you know, can be considered qualified spiritual guides. And then how do we relate to those people? And, you know, like, we already have some people that come through here now that, for example, Venerable Robina, there's several people that see her as their guru. And she is, you better be ready for that one. That's like a tornado coming at you. And it's not easy. You know, to see Robina as a Buddha all the time, no matter what's coming out of her mouth or whatever she's doing, is a great opportunity to practice at seeing your mind. Because she is special. She's very special. The proximity to the teachers. This, it's what now?
I think that's what his question was. Something related to that. We're not living in a monastery with the teachers like they used to do in Tibet.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of people grow up with their gurus in a house. I mean, they grow up, their teacher is there in the house with them. And, you know, their teacher might even be paying for all of their food, basically, and then educating them all the way up until the more advanced teachings. Whereas here we are in this country, and also, you know, Geshe Noam Dargi told Alex, and I think I'm not exactly quoting this, but he said, you need to relate to the teacher as if he's a wild animal. A dangerous friend. In other words, as the nun, Holly, you know, with the red hair, kind of beautiful blonde red hair when she was not a nun, she said it's very painful to be confronted by your ego every day of your life, because Lama Zopa, you know, his job is to train her. His only job is to help us see our mind and transform it. And so the teacher may not say what you want to hear. There's always, you see all these Zen pictures of the teacher picking you up and taking you out the door and throwing you out the door, you know, and you go, oh, thank you. I needed that. I just got a chance to see my ego and now my nose is over here. But anyway, so gurus, I mean, qualified teachers, you know, in the beginning, they can be very kind and gentle, but they can also be quite wrathful later on. Once they develop a solid relationship with the student and they know that you know, you're not going to run away, if they have a little tough love, they will give you exactly what you need. And that's one of the qualities of a qualified guru. They know your mind better than you do. Now that sounds pretty woo-woo, doesn't it? They know your karmic predispositions better than you do. And so they can, this is why we need to become a Buddha, because we need to be able to have that ability to see what people's karmic predispositions are and then give them the practices that they need to cut through the ego and develop the qualities. That's one of the things, that's what we're looking for in a guru, is somebody who can give us that kind of guidance. So they're not common. But I think if we practice and it sincerely practice and create the karma, then we'll meet the guru. You know, we'll meet at whatever level we are, we'll meet somebody that will suit our needs. And we might have to move, you know. We might have to go to California. Or a lot of people have moved to Cary. Robbie came to Cary to be near Kanapa Center back in the day. and we had Geshe Soga at the time. So let's do let's close it for the night. It's kind of getting there. Golly, it's way past time. I'm so sorry. Okay, so let's do the, let's just close with a moment of silence. There's a lot of conversation. I didn't have a clock tonight. That's my excuse. I know it's behind me. But, you know, just think about, just kind of digest. You don't have to think about anything. Lots of words have been said. Think about what you might want to take away, though, from this evening. And now, in summary, you know, we have individually and collectively created a lot of positive potentials. You know, we call it merit. We call it karma. We planted karmic seeds. And to the degree that our motivation has been selfless, those seeds will definitely ripen in future happiness. And we want to give that energy a specific direction. And that's that we can become enlightened in order to help others. That as much as possible, we dedicate our life to others. And so we want to dedicate this energy, this positive potential, these seeds that we planted to the benefit of all beings. Okay, thank you. Sorry, I went over. Next week that we start at 6:30 and we'll go to at least 9.
And I posted the link for Alexander Berzin's site on the Discovering Buddhism material page, which is where you have to go to get your online reading, and sort of the online reading and the reading in Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand.
Yeah, and the Berzin site is very, very interesting.